mean, you know, when Bat 2 came, I never anticipated what Anything for Love was going to be number one in 25 countries. I mean, it stayed number one here for 5 weeks, and the album was on a couple of weeks, and the album was number, you know. So it was sort of like, you know, a bit of a payback for Bat.
The beat is yours forever.
Again, Bat 2, for, what was it, November of 93 and parts of December of 93,
right.
was the biggest selling album in the world.
No, I won't do that. Anything for love. Oh, I would do anything for love. I would do anything for love. But I won't.
All right, Meatloaf right here in the studio with Redbeard.
Meatloaf was born Marvin Lee Adey in Dallas, Texas, the son of an ex-cop and a gospel-singing mother who taught school while exposing young Marvin to a wide variety of American music, including Broadway show tunes. Ever since Bat Out of Hell, plus his parallel career in musical theater and Hollywood movies, Meatloaf has exhibited a penchant for epic-length musical sagas which defy the notion of the 3-minute pop song for American radio. Turns out that European tastes are more Meatloaf-friendly. Primarily because of his phenomenal success with Bat Out of Hell, Meatloaf was being served up in huge portions, and certain business associates were lined up at the trough of the gravy train. But after the deaths of both parents, the real Marvin Lee began to max out his American excess account.
We did 222, and it killed me. It literally destroyed me. It was so, I was like a freight train that had been stoked with wood till it could hold no more and was pulling 100 cars behind me and was going for it. You know, I was, and it wasn't the glory. It wasn't anything. What it was what you said about, remember Clive Davis? The whole time that I was doing this was my vengeance at Clive Davis. Yeah, Clive Davis was my motivation, which I've never told anybody. But Clive Davis, I still don't like him, you know. But he was the motivation. So if nothing else, because he called me the Ethel Merman of rock and roll, and did we ever listen to rock and roll? And I wanted to shoot him. Oh yeah. So, it was such a freight train, and it was so fast and so furious, and so many people. You know, we were the number one selling album in the world at one time. In that, in 1978, in the summer of 78, there was nobody even close to us, and it completely destroyed me. I had a nervous breakdown. It was like I rebelled totally. I refused to sing, and then when they wanted me to sing, I said I couldn't sing, and so I quit. I said, I can't do this because I didn't want to be a star. I'd never been to a psychiatrist. I'd never even thought about going to one. But I went to a psychiatrist after this because people were calling me a star and I couldn't deal with it. I didn't like it. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a performer. I wanted to be anything, but I didn't want to be a star. I didn't like it. I didn't like what went with it. I didn't want the responsibility of it. You know, I couldn't take this. I mean, you can hear me now. I couldn't take it. I remember this, and it was like really a horrifying experience. But I really lost it, you know. And I tell you what, in December of 78, I had, I went up and spent some time with Billy Joel because, you know, he was dealing with it. And so I went up and talked to him and his wife Elizabeth at the time, you know, spent several days, well, not in, you know, but they lived down the street from me, and I would hang out there and talk to Bill. He had a broken leg, I believe, at that time. He was in bed, and I went up there and we watched New Year's Day football games together and stuff like that. And he sort of talked me down a bit, you know. He was helping me out, But I mean, I was like, I was nuts. I mean, I could not. So I just, I ran away from it for 2 years. And then I decided I wanted to do it. And then I really couldn't sing, you know, and I went to L.A. and did a whole thing. And, you know, people have, oh, you know, people have really hated me for that. Because not so much anymore, but they really didn't like the fact that I ran away from that kind of stardom, that I couldn't follow up with that. You know, like they're saying that I could have been so huge and everybody could have made so much money and this whole thing. It's just a long, it's they, you know, they always, you know, it's like they, I don't like they, you know. They already, you know, they had eaten me alive. And then it took me, oh, how many years to recover from, you know, the piranha attack. You know, I wouldn't even show my face in this country until, you know, 85. And then, you know, like we just started to play again. Yeah, what is it? It's been 11 years and I'm starting to play in America again. And it's been fun. And I, you know, I went to psychiatrist and psychologist and, you know, went through a small phase with drugs, which was like real stupid on my part, which, you know, I would never, I mean, it's like, I don't drink. I never have, you know, so it's like a real stupid thing for me to do that. And I even was drinking at that period of time, and I can't even fathom that because I hate it. I can't even stand the smell of it. And it's, you know, how people have phobias to things, and I have a phobia against alcohol. I mean, I the smell drives me crazy. Like a beer, you know, like a cold beer doesn't bother me. But, you know, after a beer bottle's been open for a while, it's been sitting around, you know, I really cannot deal with it. One of the key things that ever happened to us in that whole time, besides Saturday Night Live, which is a whole nother story. They didn't want us on Saturday Night Live. John Belushi was a friend of mine. Gilda, I had gone out with in time. We'd gone to the film, not really, you know, we dated, but we didn't date, you know, it wasn't like romantic. It was like friends going out when we didn't have anything to do. But I'd known John when this came out for like 6-7 years, and Chevy and Gilda, and I didn't know the others. I knew those three. John and everybody had been, you know, really wanting us to come on. And I don't know why they didn't want us on, because Lauren Michaels, I auditioned not for Saturday Night Live, but I wanted to sing on the show when it opened. I had gone in when John, I went with John to audition for Saturday Night Live. John and I went together, as a matter of fact. I was along. Walter Yetnikoff refused to ever have another CBS act on if we didn't get on. He pushed the big button and we got on. And that's what broke 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad as the single, was Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live, because that was when you played Saturday Night Live back then, that's when, I mean, it would sell 100,000 records the next week. So Saturday Night Live, that was responsible for taking it over the top in America. I mean, we had started to build and we'd started to sell now, and radio stations were starting to play it. But Saturday Night Live was responsible for that, and a show, and the Dutch television was responsible for breaking in Europe, but a show called Old Grey Whistle Test in UK, doing Paradise, was responsible for the UK. And Old Grey Whistle Test also aired in Australia, so that was responsible for that. So it was, like I always said, it was the visuals that conquered it, you know, but you could have never done this without those songs. You know, it's like, I'm great live, but the songs tell the story, and I am a vehicle for those songs. And Jimmy, I've always said to Jim, you know, he's had hits now, you know, with you know, Bonnie Tyler and people like that. But I still say to this day, Jim, there is nobody can sing your songs like me.
Once a beautiful Miss America married Mr. Right, had a little baby girl born on a stormy night. But that was once upon a time, now it's a brand new world. Give me the future, give me the future, give me the future with a modern girl. Give me the future, give me the future, give me the future with a modern. Between the past and something dawning new, there's a
Mr. Right.
Modern Girl comes from Meatloaf's 1984 album Bad Attitude.
That's also the key to all of these songs and everything we've ever tried to do. I've always attempted to take me out of the picture and allow you to put yourself into the picture as opposed to you watching me. I think that's very important. I mean, I have always in my mind, even on Bad at Hell, even though I couldn't communicate that, I understood what I was thinking, and I figured out how to communicate it over the years, thank goodness. Because, you know, I'm just a good old Texas boy who just figuring out how to communicate. Yeah, I am. So that's what we've always tried to do. And I never heard anybody else say that until the actor Michael Caine. I saw him in an interview, and he said, I don't want you to – I almost fell out of my chair when he said it because I'd really never heard anybody else say it. He said, I never want you to see me in these pictures. I always want you to see yourself. And I went, whoa, man, either both of us are crazy or we're very intelligent at some point. Because I really think that's the key, as opposed to you hearing about, you know, when I lost, you know, Renee or Nancy or whatever, and, you know, or I got up this morning and really needed a cup of coffee. It's, you know, we never sing about that. We sing about those white hot intense moments in people's lives. This is real simple. The ones that you always say to yourself, you get in these situations. Everybody does, not every day, thank goodness, but, you know, in a period of time, you say, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And that's the key word. I can't believe this is happening. And it could be in any, you know, at any level, whether it's, you know, I can't believe this is happening. This is great. Or, you know, it's like I don't believe they're doing this to me, which I say that all the time. That's my standard phrase. I wake up saying that. I don't believe they're doing this again today. What are these people, crazy? And then... And then the sad moments. I don't believe it happened that way. You know, so that's the moments that all these songs are about. And it's like Star Trek. You know, just transport yourself into that song. My mother, when I was a kid, my mother listened to 3 or 4 different albums all the time. I guess 5 that just come to mind. 1, 2 were musicals: Carousel in Oklahoma, original soundtracks. Tennessee Ernie Ford, Mahalia Jackson. So I knew all the words really to Oklahoma. This is a comment that I really like. And I'm in there singing to Oklahoma. I don't know how old I was, maybe 8, 9 years old. And my mother passed by, and I don't remember the exact words, but it was something like, you like that, don't you? And I went, yeah, yeah. And then she smiled at me and she goes, well, it's a good thing you're never going to be a singer. So I've always remembered that. And I go, yeah, I guess so, Mom. And she said that to me on more than one occasion. But this guy said to me, you know, you have a really good voice. He said, you just sing loud. He said, you just always sing loud. He says, you need to develop, you know, some technique to it, to, you know, so you can get soft instead of just always loud, you know, so you can sing soft. And so I said, okay. And then he turned to me and he said, you should put some vibrato in there. And I looked at him like, what's vibrato? And he goes, you know, where he goes, duh, you know. So I said, oh, okay. And so I went away, and I don't think I sang for about anything for like 4, 5, 6 months. I sat in a room over in Echo Park in Los Angeles every day and tried to work on getting the voice to, you know, come down and have some qualities about it and get that vibrato in there. And I did. And then when I met Steinman, we even did it even more with Steinman stuff. You know, it's like that Jimmy calls it the hush voice. Yeah, okay, now use the hush voice in here. And that's what's on 2 out of 3. That's what, kind of what's on Heaven Can Wait. It's kind of this, and it's really difficult. And then when you lock into it sometimes, it's really difficult to get out of it. So anyway, it was just working on it. I really worked on it for 4 or 5 years, putting vibrato in and getting the different things. And then just over the year, I mean, I think at this point, because I've toured so much, lost my voice more times than anybody, that I could be like, I really think I could write a book on how to sing, and I think I could get everybody in the world to become a singer, just because it's not, it. I mean, some people have, you know, there's certain cavities you have in your head and your sinuses and your chest that give certain tones that people don't all have that tone. But, you know, Jagger's sinuses are a little strange, but he's still, you know, unlike his sinus and cavities are completely different than Pavarotti's. But it works for him, and I really think that anybody can sing if they just understand the technology of it.
You can run away forever, but there's nothing wrong with getting a good head start. You want to shut out the night, you want to shut down the sun, you want to shut away the pieces of a broken heart. Think of how we lay down together, we've been listening to the radio so loud and so strong. Every golden nugget coming like a gift to the gods. Someone must have blessed us when he gave us those songs. I treasure your love,
show you how to use it. You've been through a
there's another word involved in that, and that's called driven. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of they want to. It's a matter of they have to.
Ooh.
That's the key. It's not something you want to do. It's something you have to do. There is no wanting. It's you have to. And some of the, you know, it's just like some of them are like mind-boggling. The one that boggles my mind the most driven person I think in the music business is Madonna. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I honestly believe that. I don't think I've seen, and I'm driven and I'm competitive. And I promise you, this woman is like beyond driven. Wow. I've never seen anything quite like it. Hmm. That alone, to me, is very impressive. Because mm-hmm. you have to understand how driven that is. I actually know the precise moment when I knew that, because like I said, there's want and have to. And in the 60s, I wanted to do, you know, I wanted to be in this rock and roll band, and then I wanted to do hair, you know, because it was like, okay, sure, why not? Yeah, I want to do this. And you want to do things, and, you know, there became a point, and it was actually, I don't remember whose apartment it was, but I know who I was talking to. I was talking to, it was in like 71, and I was talking to Teddy Neely. It was right before I met Steinman, which was very interesting. I was talking to Teddy Neely, who was Jesus in the movie Jesus Christ Superstar, and his wife or girlfriend named Kay Cole. And we were talking about, you know, singing and show business. And I don't remember the line I said, but I said something. And when I said it, my brain took another click. And all of a sudden, it was like, I remember turning to them and going, you know what? I'm ready. And dominoes just fell. I mean, it was like a domino effect, and it just fell. Now, that didn't make it easy. I'm telling you what, everything that I've had and everything that I've gotten, I can point blank stand up and tell anybody, look them straight in the eyes and go, you know what, I worked really hard for this, and I don't think anybody understands how hard, what kind of work it is. And so when I go back and I talk about Madonna and what she's done, how hard that work is, and any performer that has got to that has hung around a long time, you know, the Claptons, anybody that has been here, you know, longer than 15 minutes, the work, you get some, you know, you get some extraordinary favors that come along, like, you know, if you call up a crowded restaurant, you can get a reservation, or, you know, I can probably get a couple of tickets to the World Series game or something like that. But those are the little perks. But to get there, you have to work your ass off. This is not anybody who thinks that this is, you know, like money for nothing, chicks for free, you know, Dire Straits. I got news for the refrigerator pairman. You want to know about work? You want to know what it is? Come and step in the shoes of some of these people. You'll find out about it, because it is, you flat get tired, and I'm telling you, this is the hardest thing. I can't, you know, other than getting hit by some 300-pound defensive lineman, you know, I think anybody who does anything to that intensity level, like a football player or a doctor or a true teacher, I think anybody who takes that professional,
I think the word is commitment,
you know, that horse and puts that reins on, that commitment, yeah, that commitment, I think they work hard. And I think anybody who does that can sit here and say, you know, you work hard. And I know that, you know, if you're out on the street, working on the street, you work hard, but you take it off and you go home. You never take these things off. I watch my mother as a teacher. There's no off. There was no off for my mother. She was a teacher. She taught at school. She came home. She did this. She did that. She had to write this. She had to do that. Weekends, she was doing this. There was no off. If you're a doctor, there's no off. If you're a professional football player, yeah, you get off, but you still have to do that. And if you're an entertainer, you know, you can take a break, but there's no off.
Now, I took parapsychology at North Texas State, and we used to go on ghost hunts, which is very bizarre, a little thing to do. And they used to go, and I would go in the cars with them and then chicken out and say, I'm not going in there. And I'd sit in the cars while these guys went in and looked for ghosts. Now, I don't think they ever saw one, but they went and looked a lot. You know, because in Dallas, people, you live in Dallas, and White Rock Lake, the Lady of the Lake, I cannot tell you how many times we set out at White Rock Lake looking for the Lady of the Lake. I mean, I felt really stupid after years and years of that. Oh, no, he claims that he no, see, if you talk to Jim, Jim, like, claims to live with ghosts and stuff. I mean, oh, yeah, he's fine. He got no problem. I mean, Jim is a very strange human being. Jim lives by himself, has always lived by himself. He now, though, doesn't live by himself. And I'll tell you how interesting Jim is. Jim is like a nocturnal person. You know, it's like he sleeps all day and is awake all night. Now, Jim can literally go out into the backyard. He'll see deer and can go out with food in his hand, and the deer will come up and eat out of his hand. So Jim is a true, you know, one of those, like a Hughes kind of guy. You know what I mean? He's like, he doesn't have long fingernails, but he's got long gray hair. So, you know, he's a very strange, he has a family of cats. He has about 80 cats. He's got a lot of, he bought a house for his cats. I mean, the guy's real strange, and he's real smart, and, you know, he's a fun kind of guy. He's got a real good sense of humor, too.
Maybe you just be for you.
Move mountains if you want me to.
And walk across the fire for you.
Do anything you ask me to.
I'd laugh for you.
Hi, I'm Meatloaf, and I'm in the studio with my greatest hits. Neverland is Jim's connection to every song he's ever written. And if Neverland is a play, it's a futuristic version of Peter Pan. And it's a very strange thing, and I think Jim has always pictured himself as Peter. I'm Tink. And he uses, he's used Bonnie Tyler as Wendy and Celine Dion as his Wendy. And it's like that's his world. And so those, they're perfectly legitimate when people go off and do, you know, it's just another piece of the world. Like when Celine Dion did It's All Coming Back to Me Now, she was Wendy. When Bonnie Tyler did Total Eclipse of the Heart, she was Wendy. He's Peter. And if anything, if that play ever gets done, I don't think he can ever write another song. Because he has no place to go. And every song that he's ever written in his entire life is in this play. And when he writes a new one, it goes in the play. The play is now about 14 hours long. Yeah, well, I can explain it this way. It would be saying, like, Tennessee Williams writes a play, right? Mm-hmm. And for that play to actually be able to work, it would have to be done by Tennessee Williams, and he would have to do every character. Because it just, you know, there's no way an actor could, or a performer could ever come on stage and do anything to that song. I mean, and how absurd is that statement? That if Neil Simon writes a play, and that only Neil Simon can do the play, or Shakespeare had to go do all his parts, or else the play could never work, and you could never understand the play, and you could never bring the meaning out. You could never see what it was about. That's an absurd rock. See, a lot of these rock people that you just referred to are rock elitist, and they're ignorant. And anybody who would ever say that, make that statement, is Beard is really an ignorant human being, and really probably should just be taken out and shot. Because they're
Let's just get down to it.
Yeah, because they're totally useless to the rest of the world.
And by 1984's Bad Attitude album, Meatloaf was no longer singing the songs of Jim Steinman. God-given talent is an obvious necessity for anyone to make it in the entertainment business. But for greatness and true staying power, Meatloaf knows that talent needs to be matched by something else, which no one can teach.
How did you handle the white-hot spotlight of success after all that struggle?
Well, I didn't handle that well. Because we go back to this thing of that we talked about early on, driven. I remember the conversation, and I had it with everybody that was around me. I had all these people around me. But I looked at them, and I said, this train is going to go. I am the engine. You can either lock your car onto it and go for the ride or get out now. That was my image for that whole period of time. And any time that I got tired or I got down, I still can see it. I'm this engine and this train, and I'm just like a charging bull, and I just lowered my head. This is part of the problem that happened to me is I really did. I lowered my head and just went, sort of defensive lineman tactic, you know, to block a hole on a goal line stand. And I just lowered my head, and I should have peaked because I couldn't see what was going on around me.
What do you attribute that
to? And there was total corruption was going on around me. That's really what was going on around me, was total corruption. And then the thing is this. You hire people, or at least you think you are, to help guide you, to help come to you and not be afraid of you and not be yes men and come to you and say, meet, look at me, look me in the eyes, and I'm going to tell you something. You need to take a break. You need to stop. The record is working. You've proved your point. Now stop. Let's go home. Let's go here. Go down somewhere. Take him to the Bahamas. Put him in a room. You know, give him some iced tea. You know, show him some water. Do anything. Stop this man. But nobody did. And the key word is greed. Because there comes a point when you get that driven and that motivated that you can't stop yourself. And a lot of people have killed themselves from that. Joplin's, the Hendrixes, you know, I know where those people were. I know where they were. And it's scary to know where somebody like that is and how that can end and how that can lead. And I just sat in my apartment and said, okay, man, I got it. Okay, I got it. Chill. And so I just stopped. And when I stopped, I realized that they were trying to put us back in the studio to do another record. And I mean, I knew this was going on, but I didn't ever stop to think about it. And then when I stopped and thought about it, the record was identical to Bat Outta Hell. Mm-hmm. We had an answer for Bat Outta Hell. We had an answer for Paradise. We had an answer for All Revved Up. We had an answer for this. Everything was just, and the quality wasn't as good. And so basically, I totally rebelled. And when I rebelled, because I had been so nuts behind Bat, they sued me. They did, you know, all these things. And I was nuts behind Bat. I mean, I don't drink. And I was so crazy that I was drinking Jack Daniels. I was really drunk out on a stage, and I can never imagine being there, but I would really lost my mind. I was crazy. And somebody should have stopped me and pulled me away and calmed me down. But they couldn't, because all they saw was dollars. And that's all that they were concerned with.
How did you get estranged from the one person who had believed in you and stayed with you through all of this, through all the doubting Thomases, through all the...
Ooh, greed. Steinman?
Steinman, exactly.
That's an easy thing. Steinman is not a strong human being. And that's, you know, he's not strong. He wants things... But he's not driven, he's not compelled to go get them. When given certain things, he works really hard. In other situations, he's very lazy. But he's not determined. He's never been driven. I was the driven one in this bunch. And what happened was, I said corruption earlier. Well, there was people that were managing myself and Jim Steinman that were corrupt. And basically thieves. And once my sanity came back to reality and I got back to looking around and going, what in the hell is going on? I had this meeting with this guy over on Columbus Avenue in New York at a place called O'Neill's with my wife. I said, I'm firing you. And he said, you're making a huge mistake. And I said, I don't think I'm making a huge mistake. And he goes, well, you are. And I said, no, I'm not. And he says, well, you know what? We have more money. We have more power. We have more people in our pocket than you will ever know about. We're going to take everything you got, and you'll never work again. And I said, all that may be true, but you know what? And this is back to this driven thing. I said, let me tell you something. You're going to know you were in a fight when this is over. I said, you're going to know you were in a fight. You're not going to come out of here clean. And I just got up and walked out. And it was brutal. It was brutal. You wouldn't wish this on somebody that was your worst enemy, what went down with that. And that particular guy that I said that to eventually wound up in Sing Sing, in Ossining, New York,
no
in
kidding.
Prison.
Wow.
Yeah. And because they were associated with John Gotti.
Wow.
And I knew that. And that's when I escaped finally in 1984 and went to England. It was because in the Daily News, They were having the Gotti trials, and my name appeared on the subpoena list.
Oh, come on.
To come testify in the Gotti. Oh, yeah. Testify in the Gotti trials, and I went to England. And that's when I recorded that album, Bad Attitude. I packed up and went to England, was there for a year. Because I did not want to go downtown to a John Gotti trial. That particular human being turned state's evidence isn't in the witness protection program right now.
Wow.
So that's who I was dealing with. And it was just it was awful. It was really bad. It wasn't, you know, if I look back on it, it wasn't as bad on me, but what was happening to my wife was just, you know, she was like this outside, you know, this realm kind of a victim, and so were my kids, and it was just they're just evil people. I mean, bottom line, you know, there's good people and there's evil people, and these guys were evil. I mean, you know, when Bat 2 came, I never anticipated what Anything for Love was going to be number one in 25 countries. I mean, it stayed number one here for 5 weeks, and the album was on a couple of weeks, and the album was number, you know, so it was sort of like, you know, a bit of a payback for Bat. Again, Bat 2, for, what was it, November of 93 and parts of December of,
right.
of 93,
right.
was the biggest selling album in the world, doing, you know, 500,000 records a week, if not, you know, between 500,000 and 1,000,000. It was like an instant replay of Bat. Only this time I didn't have my head down. I had my head up, and I was looking around, and I was going, hey, this is pretty fun, you know, and in fact, John Bon Jovi is, you know, an acquaintance. He, and a younger man than me, he gave me a nice piece of advice. He said, "Meat, just put your head up and look around and enjoy."
A pact, but I'll never forget. forgive myself if we don't go all the way tonight. And I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. No, I won't. Some days I pray for soul. Some days I just pray to the god of sex and drums and rock and roll. And some nights I lose the feeling. And some nights I lose control. Some nights I just lose it all when I watch you dance and the thunder rolls. And maybe I'm lonely. That's all I'm qualified to be. That's just one and only.
Meatloaf right here in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks, Mr. Loaf, as the New York Times always identifies him. According to Meat, misunderstanding his outsized talent and the plus-sized package is fairly common. It even occurred with the first meeting with highly successful producer Rob Cavallo.
Yeah, people don't anticipate me. They get an impression of who I am, and then when they actually sit down with me and they meet me, I'm completely different than they thought. I'm a completely different human being. And so it should be, because, God, that Meatloaf persona would be a hell to live with. So I'm telling you, wow, dude. I mean, I've had people go, you don't have, wow, your house is like really clean and there's no motorcycle parts in your front yard, or you're not like, there's not like a car graveyard here. And you have little kids running around. This is early on. You have little kids running around, and there's no gold records on the walls, and no one would know you're in the music business. And, you know, it's just like, nope, you wouldn't. And then he said, well, what are you looking to do? I said, I'm looking to change everything I've done before. I said, it's got to stay Meatloaf because it's who I am. And it's, you know, I'm not going to become Snoop Dogg. It has to be, you know, the lyrics have to be there. I have to believe them. They have to be legitimate. They can't, I don't want to ever sing a song that I could not walk on a stage in 20 years from now and sing. I start with this 7 minute and 48 second suite called Should Have Been Home By Now and No Matter What. The reason is that I was never intending to record that song No Matter What. And I was sitting with Jim Steinman in the studio. He was playing me songs that they were doing from this musical that he had written with Andrew Lloyd Webber called Whistle Down the Wind, which is opening in England. And so he played me this song called No Matter What. And I seriously just started crying. Usually when he plays me songs, I laugh at him. And this was the reaction that I've never had from first time hearing a Jim Steinman song. Usually I look at him and laugh and go, that's funny. That's a good one, Jim. That's really funny, because I think everything's funny. This one, I just turned to him. I said, Jim, I didn't believe he actually wrote the lyrics, because it was so un-Steinman-like in a sense. And I said, you know, that's amazing. That's some of the best stuff, the best lyrics I've ever heard you write. And in the show, it's actually sung by children, and they don't really sing the whole song. It's just like this little abridged version of it. And the other thing, which is Should Have Been Home By Now, is also just this little passage that happens inside, you know, just like one time. It's like hard to find in the show, I think. And we put this suite together, and I didn't think I was going to like Should Have Been Home By Now. And Jimmy put the music all together for it and said, well, you should sing it here. And I said, well, I don't know if I like this or not, you know. The one time that I tried it, basically the second half of the song is what you were hearing. And I opened my mouth and it just came out, and it just, bam, struck me, and I just went, whoa.
The locusts are singing, the sun is red, it's gotten so late somehow. There's gonna be trouble, you know what they said, we should have been home by now. We should have been home by now. The thunder is rolling, the sky is black, it's gotten so dark somehow. There's gonna be danger, God, I wish we were back. We should have been home by now. We should have been home by now.
they tell us, no matter what they do, no matter what they teach us, what we believe is true. No matter what they call us, however they attack, no matter where they take us, we'll find our own way back. I can't deny what I believe. I can't be what I'm not. I know I'll love forever. I know no matter what. If only tears were laughter, if only night was day, if only prayers were answered, then we would hear God say, no matter what they tell you, no matter what they do, no matter what they teach you, what you believe is true. And I will keep you safe and strong, and sheltered from the storm. No matter where it's barren, our dream is being born.
We should have been home by
It just like does this thing. It just like the words just are so extraordinary to me. No matter what they tell you, no matter, you know, what they do, no matter what they teach us, what we believe is true. You know, it's just like no matter how they attack. I don't know. It felt like, you know, sort of going to a psychologist and telling him your life story and how you felt about it. It's a weird thing to me. It just strikes me. Rips me apart every time I go to sing. I can't get there. I have a hard time. Like, I started crying, barely got back to sing it after the instrumental on VH1 Storytellers.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Meatloaf, and special thanks to Mark Abramson of Roadrunner Records. For interviews and exclusive live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Barbarossa Limited Productions. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunette. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.